here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
You're listening to Evening Under Lamplight, episode 145, entitled Stuck at the Gate. And we come to you from the Gwydir Street studios of Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. And I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, inviting you to attend with us to the further adventures of Dante, progressing deeper into the hell of the Inferno. No, this is not a video game or a comic book. This is the real thing. The great poem of the 14th century, one of the very greatest works of any kind by any person in the history of the world. And you know, it's not outrageous to make such a statement. Anyone attending to this poem would easily agree with me. I hope you're beginning to see the point too. Now, you may remember that we left Dante and Virgil last time as they had just crossed the swamp of the River Styx. They've now come, Virgil tells Dante, to La Città Canome Dite, the city of Dis. Dis being the classical god Dis, or Pluto, the king of hell. Thus, all of the Inferno is his realm, but so far we've been travelling in the outskirts. Now we're about to enter into the real part of hell, the city itself. And remember, in Dante's time, especially in Italy, which was composed of strong city-states, the city was seen as something grand, an area of civilized culture in the midst of wild, rough countryside. I'm not sure cities carry anything like that sense for us today. Cities for us are places of dirt and confusion and danger, as well as culture and opportunity. I remember a long time ago someone telling me that when she was young, the 1940s, I suppose, the women always wore white gloves when they went shopping downtown. Now that's a watered-down version of what a city means to Dante. A place that was special and called for your best behavior. I wish she had also said that the city in her day was a place where everyone cooperated for the common good. Then she'd be closer to what Dante has in mind by an ideal city. But of course, here in hell, the Città di Dite is a ruined city, turning upside down all the virtues Dante expects in a true civic life. And we'll see more of this as we descend further.
Since you got me here, I see you're trying to steal my soul. Your army's trying so very hard to find for me a goal. But where's your quiet pastures where there's time for me to be? Nothing else but what I am, and that's what seems scared to see. You cover up your emptiness with brick and noise and rush. Oh, I can see and touch you, but don't owe reality much. Have mercy, I cry, city, you're all upon my mind. And sometimes I think you keep forgetting that you don't know me. Mercy, I cry, city, you're all upon my mind.
That was the Incredible String Band's Mercy, I Cry City. Sometimes, he says, sometimes I think that only the sun knows how to be quietly bright, because nothing in the modern ruined city knows how to be quiet. Now, a little recap. The areas of hell we have already seen, the suburbs, we might say, have represented the sin of incontinence, that is, those states of the soul in which we choose the good things in life, sex, food, money, and possessions, but fail to limit ourselves and fail to choose the right way of enjoying these things. It's not that we have chosen to go wrong, but we have just failed to stop ourselves headed down the wrong path. As a bad motorcycle with the devil in the seat going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street. In other words, this is the area of overindulgence, or worse, a kind of passivity as we allow these things to take over our lives and give up the use of il ben dell'intelletto, the good of the intellect. But now, in the city of Dis, we will encounter a different kind of sin. Here are the souls who willed to do evil. As we will see, they are divided into two main categories with several subcategories. First, those who chose to be violent against others, against themselves, and against God and nature. And second, those who practiced fraud. And there are many different and fascinating varieties of fraud here. Now, being a medieval city like any other city in Dante's time, the city of Dis is envisaged as a walled fortress with the river Styx acting as a moat around the walls. Just as the sins contained here are those we have to choose deliberately, so we have to choose deliberately to enter through the gates of this place. Dante makes a point of mentioning that the walls of this fortress seem to be made of iron. Rather surprising to someone in Dante's time when walls would have been made of stone. But here the iron wall gives us a symbolic message, the image of a rigid and determined obstinacy in ill-doing, as Dorothy Sayers puts it. Now, still approaching the shoreline, Dante can make out the towers of buildings behind the walls, and they're glowing red as if they'd just been taken out of the fire. Virgil explains that the glow comes from the eternal fire burning inside them. But there's a problem for us right at this point. Dante doesn't quite say that he sees the towers of buildings. He says he sees the mesquite, the mosques. There's a problem because since mosques are Islamic, Dante seems to be playing into the hands of those Islamophobes who are looking for any excuse they can find to condemn Islam and everything associated with it. And this is so obviously a wrong-headed, exclusivist, uncharitable attitude that we must not allow ourselves to get sucked into it. We need to distinguish between Dante's cultural material and his poetic material. Culturally, sure, the enemy was Islam. In fact, to approach an enemy fortress and see minarets rising behind the walls is a kind of vision from the Crusades, where Christian Europe saw its chief enemy as the Muslim cities taking over the Holy Land. The Church would have been promoting the idea that Islam was the devil's party. Dante's using the kind of reference his contemporary audience would instantly recognize. But poetically, what does this say? It's important for Dante's description of hell to show that it is a hostile place, a place at war with us, and also, of course, a place we are at war with. Dante is entering enemy territory. In one sense, the poem is a kind of spy story, and we're now at the part where the hero has to find a way through the enemy defenses. How will he do this? What will happen once he gets into this place? That, of course, is what we have to attend to next. Like all walled cities, you can enter only through the great city gates. And here, no surprise, The gates are closed against Dante and Virgil. Not only that, but there are figures lined up along the ramparts, the tops of the walls, watching Dante's approach and shouting in defiance, "Who is this who's not dead yet passes through the kingdom of the dead?" We've seen others challenge Dante's presence, but there's something different here. These are not the shades of dead human beings. These are fallen angels from the army led by Lucifer, otherwise known as Satan, that rebelled against God and was cast out of heaven down into hell. These are powerful beings, in other words, and inspire greater fear in Dante. But in the end, they, like Minos, Charon, Phlegias, and others, are merely the functionaries of hell and go through the motions but have no ultimate power over Dante. Yes, in the end, they have no power. But before Dante realizes this, they perform a crucial role in Dante's journey. Let's first go through the storyline and then try to make sense of what's going on. Virgil and Dante are standing before the gates of the city, with their enemies looking down at them from the walls. In good medieval fashion, when you're at an impasse like this, you call a truce and try to negotiate terms. And so Virgil signals that he'd like to have a few words with them, probably to explain to them that Dante is proceeding with divine sanction. This explanation has worked in the past. Why not now, too? Okay, say the fiends on the walls, but only Virgil can come for this parley. Vien tu solo, come by yourself. Let the other one, who has dared to enter this land while still alive, let him turn around and go back alone, because it seems they plan to keep Virgil here, unable to help Dante go back. Well, how do you think Dante feels when he hears this? He's in the presence of greater fear than he's ever experienced before. "Master," he cries to Virgil, "you've saved me all along the way. You're not going to leave me now, are you? If we can't get into that city, let's turn back together and get out of here." But Virgil, the symbol of reason, is calm. "Have no fear. None can prevent our passage. So great a power has granted it to us. You wait here and try to keep up your spirits. I will not forsake you in the lower world." And then one of the most arresting lines in the Inferno. Virgil says in one line, "I will not forsake you in the lower world." But then Dante tells us in the very next line, "He goes away and leaves me there." What kind of crazy world is this? He promises not to leave him, but immediately leaves him. Well, he had to go to this parley, didn't he? The demons come out of the city and meet with Virgil, but Dante can't hear what they're saying to each other. All he knows is that very soon after they begin talking, the demons run off inside the city again and slam the gates firmly shut. Virgil walks back to where Dante is waiting, walking slowly, his eyes on the ground, looking puzzled and defeated, wondering how they dared deny him passage. But once back with Dante, he picks himself up enough to show some confidence. "They've done something like this before," he tells Dante, "but don't worry. Help is coming." Even now, making his unescorted way down through the circles, one descends by whom the city shall be opened. Outside help is needed, and it's coming, so he hopes. Canto 8 ends with this vague hope that help is coming.
Ever since my life began, there have been times I need somebody here to help me understand. I can find my plan with a helping hand from you. Your help will do.
Since my time was new, there's been things I need somebody here to help me try and do. I can see them through with a helping hand from you. Your help will do. And I'll be here to help you through. Needs to find a friend who's not afraid. And I know I'll do the things I've got to do working with you. I've got a helping hand waiting to hold your hand. I've got a helping hand for you.
And there were Moki and Gobo, two of our Fraggle Rock friends, offering each other a helping hand. Let's hope that this promised helping hand that Virgil is counting on will, in fact, show up and have some effect. Well, now we move on into Canto 9 of the Inferno, which deals with the problem of how to get through those barred gates of the city of Dis. We saw Virgil holding out to Dante the hope that someone will be coming to help them. But Virgil's getting a little worried. Surely we'll be able to win this fight. Surely help was promised to us, but where is it? It's taking a long time. Dante's not reassured and asks what seems a perfectly natural question. Virgil, does anyone from your region of Limbo ever venture this deep into the pit of hell? Just asking, you know. No, not very often, Virgil answers, but admits that he himself once made the journey all the way down to the bottom of hell shortly after he had died in order to fetch a soul from there in obedience to the witch Erichtho, who had conjured him to do her bidding. Ben sol camin, pero ti fa sicuro. So don't worry, I know the way down there. The journey through hell, once travelled, never forgotten. Virgil adds that they cannot enter these gates sans ira, without anger. Mark Musa translates that as without strife, meaning that they have to overcome this opposition in order to go further. But there's also the sense that their attempts to enter will stir up the anger of those who defend the gates. Hell keeps itself closed off from our conscious examination. In other words, listen, there's something in us, deep in our shadow self, that resists any attempts to probe into the things we're doing wrong. Hence comes all our self-justifications and self-delusions, our habit of doing everything we can to keep our shameful, selfish actions locked away from ourselves and from others, as though this resistance was motivated by some kind of hostile anger against any intrusion by light and reason. The fallen angels taunting us from the walls of our own inner self. You know all about this from your own experience, don't you? Well, there's another sense to this anger, too. Virgil says anger must accompany our entrance into deep hell. We must have anger. Really? But we've just seen on the Stygian Marsh the way anger was such a destructive passion and the way Dante rejected the anger within himself, personified in Filippo Argenti. But then remember, Virgil had praised Dante for his alma stegnosa, what we might call his righteous anger, which impelled Dante, once he'd recognized the sin of anger in Filippo, to reject Filippo's approach. And Dante is going to need this righteous anger as he enters this deepest part of hell. He is going to need to see these hideous figures he'll meet as embodiments of sin, so that he will not mistake them for real people and will not pity them. But once he recognizes them, he will turn from them and move on. Virgil keeps talking to Dante, trying to calm his fears, trying to prepare him for what's coming next, but Dante's distracted from Virgil's words. Something's going on over there on top of the walls. All at once, erect, arose three hellish, blood-stained furies. Here are more monsters in hell derived from classical mythology. They have the shape of women, but with the additional horror features of having green, multi-headed serpents wrapped around their waists and snakes instead of hair, a brood of asps and adders, each a living tress, as Dorothy Sayers translates it. They're standing there, ripping at their breasts with their nails and hitting themselves with their palms, a kind of perverse enactment of mea culpa. This makes sense because in classical myth, the Furies are the external personification of our conscience, depicted as wild women who attach themselves to a guilty person and keep up an incessant screaming, haunting noise. And here they are, confronting Dante, reminding him that should he ever manage to get within the gates of this city, he'd better be prepared to be assaulted by the horrible screeching of all this guilty emotions and actions. That was Paganini's Caprice No. 1 in E major, conveying, I hope, the incessant buzzing in our ears arising from a guilty conscience, the voice of the Furies. Perhaps it's appropriate here, since Paganini's amazing virtuoso skill on the violin was often attributed to a pact with the devil. If so, he would have understood the music of the Furies well enough. Then comes the threat from the Furies. They're going to call up Medusa. She'll take care of Dante all right. And why is that? You remember Medusa, the Gorgon with the snake hair, one glance at whom will turn you to stone. Virgil immediately tells Dante to turn around and keep his eyes shut. To look at Medusa would be to turn to stone and never get back to the upper world where he belongs. No, wait, just in case Dante doesn't cover his eyes tight enough, Virgil twirls him around and puts his hands over Dante's hands over his eyes. This is obviously a crucial moment in the story, and in fact, Dante stops and addresses us, the readers, with our intelletti sani, our sound or healthy intellects. Consider the teaching that is hidden behind the veil of these strange verses, he says. Okay, so what is the teaching hidden here? Why introduce Medusa at this point in the poem? Well, it seems clear that we have come to a point in the journey when we face the possibility of the possibility of being turned to stone, becoming petrified and unable to proceed. Gil Bailey, someone who has taught me a lot about Dante, suggests that Medusa represents the hardening of the imagination, perhaps because of a trauma we've experienced or because we place too much allegiance to one particular way of looking at things, like fundamentalists and other literalists who can understand texts and life itself only on a superficial level. In literary terms, Bailey says, this hardening of the imagination will keep us from being open to the many different levels of meaning found in Dante's poem. Medusa, he says, is whatever causes me to fixate my imagination and lose, as Paul says, the spirit of the text that is my life, and the text that I interpret in order to get at my life. All we learn is what we already know. Reading a poem like Dante's Divine Comedy will do us no good. If we are literalists, we are turned to stone, and no amount of reading will ever help us progress further in intellectual, imaginative, or emotional growth. This would be like those Islamophobes I mentioned earlier, who see the word mosque and read the poem only as a confirmation of their hatred of Islam. They can take it no further. And if that's how we read the rest of this poem, all we're going to experience is the thrill of the different gruesome situations Dante witnesses on his descent. It'll be no different from some kind of video game, just spectacle, no connection to anything deeper inside us. But there's another way also to look at Medusa. If we look at the poem as the journey of Dante and all of us, deep within our own soul, to discover the parts of us we have repressed or the self-centered habits and actions we do not consciously own up to, then here we are, having examined the bad deeds of incontinence, hateful and repulsive, but now we're about to go much deeper. And there's something in us that resists this, a kind of despair that hardens our heart so we turn away from this challenge or give up, thinking we'll never do any good here. You see how Virgil proved ineffective in opening the gates. Virgil stands for our reasoning powers. Reason will not get us deeper down within ourselves. Relying on the intellect here is what Leonard Cohen once called the coward's explanation that hides behind the cause and the effect. We need to be brave and dare to face the pain within us. Notice that as soon as Dante learns that Virgil cannot help him here, he is threatened with Medusa. That is, when we realize that our intellect, defining and analyzing the situation, cannot take us deeper, then we are tempted to turn to stone, to give up the quest and go no further. The one thing reason can do at this point is warn us against this threat, as Virgil does for Dante, making sure he does not look at Medusa. Now, It's time for a little levity to balance out the heaviness of these fiends and the threat of Medusa. Let's attend to another sense of being turned to stone. I have in mind a Shel Silverstein song, performed, of course, by Dr. Hook, called I Got Stoned and I Missed It. Yes, here's another way to avoid the deeper levels of life. Just get stoned, man, and go no further. And then, as the song says, when my earthly race is over and I'm ready for the clover and they ask me how my life has been, I guess I'll have to say I was stoned and I missed it. Turned to stone and going no further. But, well, we all can see ourselves in this song in one way or another, can't we? Oh, yes, and the song goes out, of course, for Andrew Abey in Liverpool.
I was sitting in my basement. I just rolled myself a taste of something green and gold and glorious to get me through the day. Then my friend yelled through the transom, grab your coat and get your hat, son. There's a nut down on the corner giving dollar bills away. But I laid around a bit and I had another hit, and I wrote myself a bomber. Then I thought about my mama. Then I fooled around, played around, jacked around a while, and then I got stoned and I missed it. I got stoned and I missed it. I got stoned and it rolled right by, rolled on by. I got stoned and I missed it. I got stoned and I missed it. I got stoned. Oh me, oh my. Now it took 7 months of virgin just to get that local virgin with the sweet face up to my place to fool around a bit. The next day she woke up rosy and she snuggled up so cozy. When she asked me how I liked it, Lord, it hurt me to admit. I was stoned and I missed it. I was stoned and I was stoned. And it rolled right by. Where'd it go? I was stoned and I missed it. I was stoned and I missed it. I was stoned. Oh me, oh my. Making no excuses for the many things I uses just to sweeten my relationships and brighten up my day. But when my earthly race is over and I'm ready for the clover and they ask me how my life has been, I guess I'll have to say I was stoned and I missed it. I was stoned, I missed it. I was stoned and it rolled right by. I was stoned, I was stoned, I was stoned. I was stoned. Oh me, oh my.
You can't sing like that, condition.
Dr. Hook, I got stoned and I missed it. But as far as I can tell, you're not missing us here at Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Or as the magic announcer says,
when the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
So there. Now back to Dante, who is shielding his eyes from the sight of Medusa. Well, Medusa never appears. Instead, Dante's attention is drawn to an alarming event. He can't see, of course, because his eyes are covered, but he hears a sound as of a mighty wind, the kind that sweeps through a forest fire with waves of heat that strikes the forest and with unchecked force shatters the branches, hurls them away, and magnificent in its roiling cloud of dust, drives on, putting beast and shepherd to flight. Something's coming like a firestorm. Virgil now frees Dante's eyes and points to a spot on the Stygian marsh where the vapor is most dense and harsh. Something's moving and coming their way, scattering all those angry, biting souls who rush out of its way. It's some divine messenger, da ciel messo, sent from heaven to help, skimming on top of the water, or rather above the water, con le piante asciutte, with the soles of his feet dry. Just gliding through this stinking mess of a place, clearing the air in front of him with his hand as though it's just a nuisance he has to pass through. Virgil signals for Dante to keep silent and bow to the heavenly presence. We might expect something grand to happen, some fireworks, as this heavenly being clears the way for Dante to enter the gate, but in fact, it's a little anticlimactic. Approaching the gate with disdain, he taps it with his wand, and the gate opens with no resistance. That's all it takes. And then he speaks a few words to the fallen angels on the walls. Haven't you learned yet that resistance to the divine will is futile? And then turns and walks back, not even looking at Dante, rushing off as though really now he has more important things to do than deal with these trivial matters in hell. Okay, so who exactly might this figure be, and what's the significance? At first, it can look like a Christ image, since in one of his most famous moments, Jesus walked across the water of the lake to join his friends in their boat. But Jesus didn't carry a wand, and anyway, he walked on the water, not over the water, if we can make such a distinction. So what then? Should we call it an angel? Angels are divine messengers. And the sense seems to be that when reason, in the person of Virgil, is at a loss, we need to have faith that some providential intervention will come to us, some inspiration, perhaps some intuitive flash that reason itself could never have come up with. We know this on one level as the Eureka moment, the path revealed as if from some source beyond us. And where does this divine message come to us? It comes to us, as Dante tells us, from out of the muck and the dense, foul atmosphere surrounding us. It seems natural that, like Virgil and Dante, we should feel some moments of anxiety and doubt. The message does not come immediately. But if we can look into the darkness and wait in expectation, it will come. This is a poem that understands existential confusion and despair, but over and over again assures us that there is a purpose in all things and a graceful hand reaching out if we're open to it. And then what happens? This messenger is not some cuddly being, not even some maternal being who gently sees after our needs. The messenger comes, does the job, and leaves. No fuss. All we are asked to do is remain silent and bow in acknowledgement of this sacred intrusion into our life. We stand back and let the divine grace do its thing. We let go, and the doors open.
Open to learn. to laughter, open to being blessed. Open to joy, open to service, open to saying yes. Open to risk, open to passion, to peace and silence too. To love, open to beauty, open beloved to you. Open beloved to you.
That was Mike Scott and the Waterboys with this gentle yet fierce affirmation of the grace of being open, especially to saying yes. But now I have another twist to our understanding of this divine messenger. Suppose we see this figure as Mercury. Mercury, or Hermes in Greek, is always depicted with his wand, the caduceus, with its twining serpents, the divine counterpart to the serpents adorning the Furies and Medusa. And remember Mercury's winged sandals, which allow him to fly over the surface of the world. This makes sense to me, and to you too, I hope, especially because once we identify, even just tentatively, this figure with Mercury, several other things fall into place. Mercury is the trickster god coming unexpectedly into our lives. He's also the god of caves and other dark places, which goes along with his sudden appearance from out of the darkness of the river Styx. But most of all, Mercury is the psychopomp. Psyche, soul, pompos, conductor. The conductor of the souls of the dead down to the underworld. And it is appropriate, then, that this divine psychopomp should be the one who appears to open the gates for Dante to descend deeper into the underworld, the Inferno, or in the psychological way we've also been looking at the poem, opening the way for us to go deeper into that underworld of our dark, unconscious selves. There's always a reason why the Greeks and Romans envisaged gods and goddesses for particular aspects of human life. They understood that there were forces beyond our merely human capacities at work here, and they knew that our reasoning power, strong and noble though it is, cannot open for us our inner doors. We cannot reason ourselves into deep self-examination. As we've said before, there's too much strong, irrational inner resistance, which will not respond to logical argument. Hence the need for Mercury, the psychopomp, to conduct us through this step. And the good thing to remember is that even though Mercury may lead us, indeed often does lead us, into dark and painful places, in the end, he's always the bringer of good fortune. Dante's journey will take him to the most painful and horrible visions of human life and of his own life, but in the end, it will lead him ultimately up through the heavens and finally to l'amor che muove il sole e l'altre stelle, the love that moves the sun and the other stars. Now here's Mercury, the winged messenger from Holst's Planets. And so Dante and Virgil can now enter the gates and proceed into lower hell. Dante eager to find out what it's like inside these walls, which the fiends were so strong to keep him from seeing. So what does he see? Well, more torments, of course. He sees a wide plain stretched out before him, the ground covered in tombs, which picture large oblong boxes, the kind of raised tombs that rich people might be buried in, either inside the church or in a churchyard. Around the tombs are flames of fire, making the tombs themselves glow hotter than iron before it is worked. But there's something odd here. The stone slabs that should form the lids of the tombs have been propped open, so Dante is able to hear the groans and cries of pain and despair from the souls confined within these tombs. "What's going on?" Dante asks Virgil. "Who are all these people?" "Well, they're the heretics," Virgil says, "and the tombs are filled with more souls than you'd suppose. The souls of people of similar heresy are entombed together, and different tombs burn with different intensity, depending on the seriousness of the heresy." And then Dante and Virgil start walking around this region. But that's for next time, when we'll look at what heresy is all about, and find two proud heretics who rise up from the tomb to confront Dante. Stay tuned till next time for more. We're almost at the end of this evening's episode Under Lamplight, and let me thank you for coming to attend this evening's Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105. Come to the archives at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk and get in touch with me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight@cambridge105.fm. But now, to see us out, let's attend to a Leonard Cohen song. Perhaps the song that gave him the reputation of writing songs to commit suicide to. But that's unjust, as you know, of course. This is a song about death, but it's about mystery, too. Who by Fire? A catalogue song listing all these possibilities for being taken away, with the refrain, "And who shall I say is calling?" Well, we know who's calling, don't we? It's Mercury, the divine messenger, the psychopomp, leading us through the death of the ego and onward, we know, to good fortune. Here's the version from his 2009 Live in London tour. And notice, too, notice the way Leonard shows that he is indeed a citizen of the divine city, not the city of Dis, if only because of the graceful way he is always ready to step back and give credit to his wonderful musicians and attend to the graceful playfulness of the musicians themselves. I mean, it's late, but try to be attentive and let the music take you where the words are directing you. Who by Fire? Good night. Thank you.
Asane, Akilao. And who by fire, who by water, who in the sunshine, who in the nighttime, who by high ordeal, who by common trial, who in your merry, merry month of May, who by very slow decay, and who shall I say, is called. And who in her lonely slip, who by barbiturate, who in his realms of love, who by something blunt, who by avalanche, who by powder, who for his grief, for his hunger, and who shall I say is God? And who by brave ascent, who by accident, who in solitude, who in this mirror, who by his lady's command, by his own hand, who in mortal chains, who in power, and who shall I say?